my name is Sam Clements and welcome to this mini edition of the Picture House podcast. Today, I am very pleased to say we are joined by director Damien Chazelle talking about his latest film, First Man, which had a really good run at the cinema and is now available on DVD, Blu-ray, streaming, all that sort of stuff. Damien was in town recently to talk about the release, and my colleague Sarah Cook had a good old chat with him. So, yeah, without further ado, Sarah Cook, Damien Chazelle, First Man, enjoy!
So my first question really is, what drew you to the project and this story?
It was really actually, more than anything, was the moment I learned that Neil and Janet Armstrong had lost a child of theirs before, right before he became an astronaut. Before I knew that, you know, I was the producers of the project first kind of asked me if I was interested in doing something about Neil Armstrong. I didn't really think I was. I didn't really want to do a biopic. They gave me this book that the movie's based on by Jim Hansen. And it was when I learned that little factoid of Neil's life and that it kind of, I would say that sort of helped trigger the change in my thinking of sort of being able to think of this person who's been so maybe mythologized to the point of us almost forgetting that he was a human being at all, to actually get to sort of think of him as a human being, to think of him and his wife as human beings, to think of that family as sort of an ordinary family struggling with profound loss, and how that may be, on the one hand, you'd think a loss like that would prevent anyone from ever doing anything ever again, but also conversely, how maybe that loss and the losses that followed, such unfathomable losses of all these people that they loved, how those maybe could have fueled the mission to the moon as well. So that kind of duality really interested me.
Yeah, there is a gorgeous story about how grief can propel a person forward.
Yeah.
How closely did you work with the family to get this kind of tragedy, Karen's death tragedy, right? And
Very, I mean, we were really lucky that the family was so gracious and generous with their time. It would have been really hard without them. I mean, by the time I started working on the movie with Josh Singer, the writer, Neil himself had passed away already a few years prior. So we knew we wouldn't get to talk to him himself, but first, we got to talk to his kids, to Rick and Mark, who proved instrumental throughout the whole. I thought we'd be lucky to get maybe one or two conversations with them, and they wound up just meeting us time and time again, meeting Ryan, spending time with Ryan, spending time with Claire, spending time with other members of the cast and crew, coming to set, reading draft after draft of the script, watching cuts of the movie. I mean, they were just so helpful throughout. And then also, what was a huge honor was getting to spend some time with Janet Armstrong as well, who was living in Ohio at the time. And I think I first met her with Josh, if I'm remembering correctly, and got to spend an afternoon with her just asking questions. I went with Ryan back up to Ohio to sit with her again and sit with the boys again. And just getting her perspective was also just really instrumental. And we wound up recording just kind of long conversations we had with her about anything and everything, which Claire then spent a lot of time listening and re-listening to and trying to get her cadences off of that and everything. And we would give her drafts of the script as well. And so again, and then there was even other people who aren't in the film, people like Neil's sister, his childhood best friend, other colleagues of his, you know, so just we tried to kind of talk to anyone and everyone who knew him, both at work and at home, to just try to get some shading to someone who was very, very private. So, you know, it's not like we could find all that we needed through interviews. We knew we needed to really talk to the real people.
It does work out impeccably. There must have been so much pressure, because not only have you got to tell this deeply personal story, you've got to tell one of the most momentous occasions in human history.
Yeah.
How did you work those two together and also honor the lives that have been lost along the way in the space race and still appeal to a new generation who might not have been there or seen it or have the ripple effect of?
It was definitely daunting. It was, you know, it was kind of certainly a sort of responsibility that I had never felt on previous movies, you know, where it was just, it seemed to be more about, I don't know, the joy of getting to make the movie at all. Here it was sort of as much as I was so thrilled and happy to be able to make the movie, it was also this sort of like, oh, okay, we're able to make it. Okay, well, now we better not screw it up. Because it's like you feel the weight of history breathing down your shoulder. But also, I think more than anything, just those real people I was mentioning, you know, knowing that like when Neil and Janet's sons were going to see the movie, that they would be seeing their parents,
yeah,
you know, on screen. And it's just this weird kind of, it's history on the one hand, but it's also a history that's very much still with us. So many of the individuals are with us today, and we knew they'd be watching and that they would, you know, want us to get it right. So it probably just inspired us even more to really do our homework and try to do our research and try to base everything in the film on. So much of it is either transcripts from the missions or kind of verbatim conversations with Janet or with their sons, or, you know, just trying to kind of, we didn't want to invent out of whole cloth too much. But then at the same time, I wanted there to be room on the set for people like Ryan and Claire to improvise and to sort of play house and to take things in different directions. So we spent a lot of time rehearsing before shooting. We spent about 2 weeks of just kind of improvised rehearsals where everyone was in costume and on the sets, and we would film those rehearsals, and some of that filming is in the final film itself. But it was really mainly a way of just kind of getting everyone comfortable enough in the particulars and the historical details and the accurate kind of world that we had constructed that they could then take liberties with it and sort of go different directions. So you try to find that balance where you are doing justice to the real story, but also trying to maintain the freedom of making a movie that wants to feel like life and not like history.
But what made Ryan Gosling so perfect for the role of Neil Armstrong? Because he does it so well.
I first met Ryan to pitch him this role before we had done La La Land together, and which means that, you know, he sort of got into my head for this role before I had ever worked with him, and it just sort of, for whatever reason, he was the only person I ever really thought of for the role. I mean, certainly there's a certain physical resemblance, but I think much more importantly than the, you know, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed sort of Neil Armstrong look, it was this kind of ability Ryan has, I think, that's pretty rare, to communicate so much with so little, to really kind of distill a character down to, you know, just a few gestures or a few looks or just a single line, but it's how he says it. It's not what he says. It's this kind of subtlety he has as a performer. It's really crucial to have someone who knows how to play in that register when you're doing someone like Neil, who was so famously taciturn and stoic. And so I think Ryan has this ability to humanize that kind of person, and while maintaining the mystery of the individual, there's still an unknowable quality to Neil, I think, that we didn't want to completely do away with in the film. We wanted you to feel like you got to know him and got into his head in the film, and yet also tried, especially by the end when he becomes, you know, the first man, to try to also do justice to a little bit of that enigma that is Neil Armstrong, that he still was someone who, like the expression, still waters run deep,
yeah,
you know, that there were these kind of untapped layers of this man that even a 2-hour movie can't entirely unveil.
It's just a phenomenal performance. And the other great performance is Claire Foy as Janet. And you said that you've met Janet. What drew you to Claire Foy? Because she's just risen to these amazing roles.
It was just such a tremendous pleasure to work with Claire because you know, she is such a chameleon in that way that some, you know, it's I still find myself amazed that someone, that a contemporary British actress could so tap into, and I say this having met Janet, so tap into someone who I think of as so fundamentally Midwestern American of her time. You know, the Janet, to me, was a very specific character and very much formed by her region and her upbringing and informed by the circumstances around her and very particular to that family and to that time. And so it felt like it was going to be a tough task for anyone, let alone a non-American, to do the role. But Claire, I think just I kind of am of, having worked with her, I'm of the belief now that she can literally do anything. I think there's no role that she can't do justice to. And I think part of that has to do with, it's a few things. I mean, she works very hard at what she does. She puts in the research, she puts in the homework, she really does the deep dive, but she also somehow has a way of making it seem effortless. She has, it's something in her eyes and in her face where, kind of like with Ryan, but in a very different way, small moments can speak volumes. Yeah. And so it was amazing to see her, you know, on the one hand, nail the accent, nail the body language, nail the whole kind of comportment of this woman. But then on the other hand, you know, in between lines, or sometimes when she didn't even, when we were just keep rolling into like an improvised part of a scene, just little flutters of her face and little kind of improvised moments that she would sneak in were always felt so true and so beautiful. She's always giving something to the camera. There was really never, when in the edit room, it was never an instance of cobbling together a performance. It was literally trying to winnow down all these riches we had and into something concise. Because it's just, I think she's endlessly talented. Yeah. And certainly having her and Ryan together, it was definitely, just as a filmmaker, it makes my job so much easier to just the joy of having two actors of that caliber who hadn't worked together before, but got along really well because they're both great artists and also really nice people, that helps, and just became this couple. They really became, in front of us, in front of the camera, this couple that had known each other for years. They kind of brought in that history just through a few weeks of rehearsals and created this family with the kids playing their kids who had never been on screen before, ever, had never been on a film set. It was sort of miraculous to watch. Yeah. It was really fun.
I mean, that final scene, they say so much without saying anything
right,
at all.
Right, and I think that again, it's the kind of scene where that scene only works if you have actors who can fill that silence.
Yeah.
I do agree with whoever it is who said that, you know, half of, if not more, of directing is casting.
Yeah. <know? laughs>
And in this case, I mean, certainly to have those two, and then also, but with all the other parts, I worked with a wonderful casting director, Francine Maisler, and it was really fun. But we knew going to be such a huge part of the movie of just picking the faces and kind of constructing this ensemble around Ryan and Claire to fill out that world, because it is so important.
Well, moving on from the human aspect of it to the technical, mm-hmm. beautiful space, I think the most exceptional portrait of space I've ever seen.
Oh, wow.
That sequence where they're just flying and they're a dot is one of my favorite bits of cinema this year.
Oh, cool.
Maybe of all time. So how did you develop the look of space in such a unique way as well? Because
I'd say it started mainly with the archival footage. There was nothing more inspiring than in the making of this film than just looking at the raw archival footage that the astronauts themselves took, the photographs they took, but also the 16 millimeter cinematography, you know, that they did. They sort of became these amateur filmmakers during these missions. And obviously a lot of that great footage is in various documentaries. A lot of it also you can just sort of find on YouTube and sort of, you know, or in the vaults. And so just getting to wade through that, it was a vision of space that I felt I hadn't seen before, and I felt that movies, at least fiction movies, hadn't seen before, where it was much more claustrophobic than I had thought it would be. It was often about what you didn't see as opposed to what you did. Yeah. You know, it'd be these fleeting glimpses out the window, but you can't get the full picture. The grain, the shakiness, the sort of the documentariness of it. I fell in love with all those things. And so it felt like, so Lena Sandgren, the great cinematographer who I worked with on the film, you know, together we sort of decided that was the style to lean into, was to try to really lean into the cinema verite feeling and try to make the audience feel like a documentary crew had kind of squeezed themselves next to the astronauts into these capsules, and that you felt in a three-dimensional way how tiny the capsules were, also how fragile they were. And then you contrast that with the giant, unfathomable epicness of space, you know? Yeah. And so this wouldn't be a movie that existed in the middle ground a lot. It would exist in the really tight close-ups and the giant, giant wides where the capsule is a dot this big. So that you felt the fragility. You felt that, you know, that these are really people on a, almost like on a little leaking ship in the middle of a nighttime ocean. And it's that scary.
It is the most terrifying thing. It's when you realize how rickety this tin can is, basically.
Yeah.
And how old and dated this technology is. And you just think to yourself, how did we ever do it in the 60s? How did they ever get there?
It's the rare subject matter where the more one researches it, and the more one finds out about it, the more confounded one becomes that it ever happened, that it ever was possible, because it's truly astonishing. And I think NASA was also purposefully, deliberately able to, in its, you know, the image it put forth to the world, was able to kind of cast the spell of sort of high tech, futuristic, you know, nothing can go wrong. We know exactly what we're doing. It's all very sleek and safe and clean, when in reality, it really was not. These people were really on a razor's edge between life and death at all times. And there were so many unknowns, so many variables, that you had to have individuals who were willing to take the ultimate risk. And it requires a certain kind of psychology that I find hard to fathom, but certainly I find very fascinating to tell a story about.
Yeah. I mean, I get worried when the tube shakes a little bit more than it should do.
I have panic attacks when the subway stops in a tunnel. It's like, I can't imagine being hurtled into deep space.
A tin can.
In a tin can, yeah.
The other thing that I absolutely adore about this film is Justin Horowitz's score, who obviously you've worked with before, because he brings a quite musical element to it that would be different than these grandeur space movies. How was it developing that kind of sound? I mean, the landing score is one of my favorite pieces of score. I mean, I can't get enough of this movie. So, like,
thank you so much. he was, you know, it's obviously I love working with him, and I think I'd be very lost without him. You know, the way he and I work is often music is at the very beginning. You know, obviously, with something like a musical, it's kind of the requirement. But even with this movie, well before we were shooting, when we were kind of early in the script days or prep, he was coming up with melodies and sending me piano demos and then trying to kind of come up with ideas for instruments that might suit things. And so he started experimenting with things like the theremin and certain old synthesizers from the era and mixing those kind of electronic instruments with orchestral, is sort of old-fashioned acoustic orchestra, and trying to sort of find that balance between old and new. It was really, it was fun, but it required a lot of time, a lot of trial and error. So I think we would have really been screwed if we had just kind of put it off to the last minute. It was really important to get that going early. And something like the moon landing cue, that was both composed and orchestrated fully before we even shot.
Wow.
And so I used that to create kind of animatics for that and other sequences, you know, like musical numbers, essentially, where you'd have the music and you'd figure out the images that fit to the music. And then, of course, there was a lot of post-scoring as well. But a lot of those key music cues came first. So in that way, in some, you know, weirdly, it felt actually somewhat similar to us to the movies we had done before.
Wow. Well, thank you very much for taking the time.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you.